Session number 9963.
Mr. Brewer, room 7.
Now, this field of fire was interrupted by a little hillock, and the church at Echa. And we were blazing away now, when suddenly the number one on my gun, Chris Smith, fell over. And I took one look at him, and the blood was seeping around the bottom of his abdomen. And my training as a St. John's ambulance man took precedence over everything else. We had no bandages, and I'd noted that over to our left on the road was an ambulance. So I told the number three on the gun, Jimmy Sullivan, a lad from the Gorbals in Glasgow, to take over, picked Chris up in my arms and carried him about 200 yards over open ground. And he recollects that his consciousness was waxing and waning, and all he remembers was that I was carrying him, and there were shouts of snipers. Now, we thought I was carrying him down the hill, but it was flat ground, dominated by the church tower. And I didn't know where the bullet had come from, but it had obviously come from our right in the vicinity of the church. So I picked him up and shielded him with my body and walked this 200 yards across to the ambulance and told them, "Now, for God's sake, get busy on this chap." And it transpired that he had a bullet. He had a bullet through the penis, of all things. And I have tried to fathom out since how that bullet had missed the number three on the gun and the number four, had missed me, but it had hit Chris in his vitals. And I just couldn't work it out. And so I handed over to him now, and I walked back across this open ground. I couldn't have run if I wanted to because of his weight and so on. And when I got back to the gun, Jimmy Sullivan now was yielding pride of place to me. Now, he had perfect eyesight, and he had an artist's or a safe breaker's skill with his hands. And he was really marvelous at laying the gun. So I was quite content. I had defective vision. It was no good at the rate of fire that we had got up to, having anybody on that gun sight with spectacles. And I always ensured that the gun was loaded at the earliest possible second on the recoil, and on the run out then I had enough strength to steady the gun as she was going home and slap him on the shoulder, and he could fire. And we were told that on that day, later on, that we achieved a firing rate of 20 rounds a minute from three guns that were 60 shells going across the fortifications on this hill. And Bobby Walker, who was commanding a company of the battalion, and he was an ex-Scots Guardsman, and they were lying down on this open ground over which they had advanced, and he made a reference to it, something about the fires of hell. And he felt sorry for these blokes who had to face up to it in these trenches. Well, then there was a bit of a commotion on our left, and Tom Wintringham, Slater and Dunbar were standing there discussing what they had to do, and suddenly Wintringham was hit in the shoulder. And it was evident to Dunbar where the fire had come from. And they got Wintringham away to this same ambulance, which had taken Chris Smith out now and returned to pick up more casualties. And Dunbar said, well, there's a sniper in the church tower. So we turned our gun on it, and first of all we rang the bell. There was a metal casing there, so we got a shot plumb on that armour piercing, and there was a response from the bell. Then we thought, no, the sniper will be coming down from the bell tower, and he would be making his way out the back door of the church. So we put another armour-piercing shell through the door of the church, and followed by a high explosive. And I didn't like it. I must admit that I had no time for Catholicism. At least the building was sacred to other people, and I didn't like the idea of stooping to the level of the enemy in regarding it as a fortified place. But of course that was a bit too chivalrous. And subsequently now, we had put over, I've forgotten how many rounds we fired, a hell of a lot. But the people on this hill surrendered, and they said that they would have surrendered earlier if it hadn't been for their officers. So the battalion got that without any casualties. And suddenly some people came up from battalion headquarters. They'd caught this man trying to get away, dressed in an ordinary trousers and a shirt with no identification. And they held a drumhead court-martial, and they sentenced him to death. And they come up to our guns now, and they wanted a firing squad.
What was the charge?
Well, being on the battlefield, dressed in civilian clothing, and obviously a soldier who was trying to escape. Now, if he'd come out in his uniform, well, by the rules of war, they would have had to make him prisoner. But the fact that he had divested himself, or if he had been a soldier, divested himself of his uniform and identity card, and that was it. And it was a very speedy proceeding, which I wouldn't have agreed. So, of course, we want a volunteer firing squad. You and you and you and you. And they pointed to me, and I said, no, thank you. I said, behind us is a legitimate government which has got legal institutions, and that man is entitled to a trial. Now, it was a point of honour to me, because that man, if it was the sniper, could have shot me in the back, and he refrained from doing so, because I was in his sights for 200 yards. I walked back, he could have shot me in the chest, and he didn't do so. So I felt that it was a matter of honour that I wouldn't be involved in shooting a man who could have put me off the planet. And I refused steadfastly, and they didn't argue with me because they could see I was determined. But now they put this chap up, blindfolded him, turned him around a few times, and he ended up with his back towards us. And these chaps, they shot him, you see. Well, I was bloody horrified and disgusted. But they thought, now these people on the hill would see this and it might take the stuffing out of them. But it didn't, because we had to re-engage and blast them out of it, as it were.
So the people on the hill could have seen what was happening?
They could have, but it was long range, you see, because on our visit in 1981 or 82... we went on to Perbello Hill, and we were looking towards the church. And they would have had to have very good eyesight indeed to see what was going on. And to me, it was just wasn't the thing to do. But the main thing was that they hadn't... The gun team knew what I'd done, the gun teams, but the higher command hadn't observed, and particularly the political Johnny. So that I escaped being classified as a hero, promoted, and made to do ridiculous things, and probably got bumped off in the process. I was quite happy to be bringing fire to bear, as I told Slater, that's what I'd come there to do. And so they took this hill. And of course I refrained, as I told you, from taking over the gun because this other chap had better eyesight. And we proceeded then with our duties to go along with the actions that were taking place, but we should have been in the forefront at Gandesa, where there was plenty of work to be done. But somehow or another, we weren't involved in that. And then I'll skip the part of our activities at Belchite, because we were right in the forefront there, and driving the defenders back into the town, the garrison. And we, our final service was in 2nd Belchite, where Franco put in a counter-attack. And we were strung out, oh God, we had a tremendous field of fire. And I don't know where battery headquarters was. And we got no instructions. And we were just there waiting for the enemy. And these light Italian tanks came over the hill. And I told the number one, Jimmy Sullivan, I said, hold your fire. Now, of course, if we had an ex-artillery man, Frank Proctor, in the battery, and if they'd made him the drill sergeant, now the one thing that we would have learned was the command to stand fast. And with the Royal Artillery, whatever you're doing, when the command stand fast is given, you freeze. And if I'd shouted at him, stand fast, and we'd had the drill, he wouldn't have fired. But he fired one armour-piercing round, which missed by about 20 yards, and these damn tanks turned in their own length and went back over the hill, because they weren't going to come forward and risk coming onto our guns. So we were sitting there now waiting for them to come again in greater force. And up comes Frank Proctor and he said, right, you've got to retreat, because otherwise we're going to be cut off. And I thought Jimmy Sullivan's comment was superb. Now you think of a chap brought up in the Gorbals in those bloody dreadful circumstances, who owed nothing to Britain because of the miserable life. His mother had died, his father struggled to rear him. They lived in a hovel. And he turned round to Proctor and he said, "Och, awa, the British never retreat." And that was our sentiment. We weren't going to damn, we were going to fight it out. So Frank started arguing with us. So he said, all right. And off he went, now back to battery headquarters, or whatever it was. 10 minutes later, he came back now, and he had Dunbar's Mauser pistol with him. The one which had the case was wooden. You opened it, took the gun out, and then the case served as a shoulder effort, you see, and it was a small rifle. So Frank came back with this now in battle order, with a round and a breech and so on. And he said, right, now, he said, I'm ordering you on behalf of the battery commander, you will withdraw. And he said, if you refuse to withdraw, I've been instructed to shoot you. And of course we had no sidearms or anything like that. We only had the gun to defend ourselves. And he said, now, I was trained in the Royal Artillery, he said, but in the Royal Artillery, when we are given an order, we bloody well obey it. So are you going to withdraw? So we agreed. We would withdraw. We wouldn't damn well retreat. Well, now, with all the goodwill in the world, we just couldn't retreat, because the driver of our lorry had absconded. Not one of us could drive, and we were there with a truckload of ammunition, our equipment, and the gun. So we set about withdrawing now. We locked the gun, closed the trails, put the drag ropes on, and we started to move. And with that, down came the Messerschmitts. Well, there was an olive grove there, and they made three squadrons came in, one after the other, and I think they shot every damn leaf off these olive trees. They assumed that there was infantry there. And we didn't know if there was any infantry there, but we didn't see any. So in the brief intervals now, between one squadron finishing and the other one coming in, we inched the gun away down this sunken road. And we got onto the tarmac now, decent road. And there was a farmhouse on our right, and there were chickens running around and squawking. So the other four now decided that they were going to get a chicken for dinner because the place would fall into enemy hands. And they went off and they said to me, "No, we won't be long, Jim. You stay with the gun." And I saw them go now towards this building, and I thought, "You silly buggers." And when we were first created as a battery, we met the General Walter. We had a reception at divisional headquarters, and he said, "Now, these guns have been brought here through great difficulties, and they are of more, remember, they are of more value to the Republic than your lives." And of all else, he said, that was what registered in my mind, and experience confirmed it, you see. So I saw them go and I thought, to hell with it. They are now risking being caught. If there were any enemy troops infiltrating, they'd had it. So I got the two drag ropes over my shoulder, picked up the trail, and off I went down the road on my own. And it was nice and flat, so I had no hills to climb or let the gun gently down on the other side. And I was going along now, expecting them to come up, catch me up at any moment. Not a damn sign of them. And
it's a wonder you could move it.
Ah, I was strong. And I didn't realise, it was only much later that I realised just how damn strong I was. And it had rubber wheels, you see. And it was beautifully balanced. And a strong chap could move it. And I'd already proved that because I'd saved the gun on an earlier occasion by simply leaping on it and dragging it out of the line of fire. And so I was going along quite happily down this road now, hoping that I'd run into somebody in authority or some troops. And I heard a motor engine. It was, everything was quiet, and there were even one or two birds singing. And there was a bend ahead of me, and nosing around it was an armoured car now, with the guns loaded, ready to fire. And I thought, oh well, if that's an enemy armoured car, I've had it. And in any case now, I was going to go into captivity with dignity as a soldier. And I kept on. Now, if it had been an enemy armoured car, or even if it had been one of ours, if I had dropped that trail and tried to run away, they'd have had me. They would have just blazed away. So I thought, one thing or the other, I'm going to keep my head. And it turned out to be one of our divisional armoured cars, one of the few they had. So this chap stopped, and he could see that I was a Republican soldier.
How?
By my lack of uniform. The fact that it was a Russian gun, and I was going in the right direction. Well, with a few words of Spanish, and a few words of English, we managed to communicate, and I warned him that I was the last Republican soldier between him and the enemy. and to proceed with caution, and if possible to get off the road and go on the side road where he could see this. And I asked him if he'd be kind enough now on his way back to give me a tow with his gun and a lift back. So about 20 minutes later now, sound of a car engine behind me, and I thought, I hope to God it's him coming back, and it was. So we lashed the used the drag ropes now, and we lashed the trail to the armoured car, and I jumped up on top and I rode back then until we got to a position of two people in authority. And we must have run into they must have been divisional staff, these two officers, and one of them said to me, now he could speak English, and he said, you'll have to surrender the gun, he said, because the enemy is likely to break through to the Mediterranean, and we want everything to be sent that we can manage to get through to the central front, because in Catalonia, he said, we can get reinforcements, but if they break through, then the centre has got to survive on what it's already got. So I did a sensible thing. I didn't argue. I surrendered it. And then attached myself to a Polish machine gun team. And I met one or two chaps with the British battalion now, so we clustered around this gun. And it was dark now. And I thought, I said, well, if I'm going to damn well die, I'm going to die in comfort, I'm going to have a sleep and put my head down on the ground now, because I was tired and the doors off. And with that, there was a bloody drumming on the ground, and I thought, good God, what's this? Because lying on the ground, you could hear it, see. And I sat up and I said, boys, stand to. And suddenly now the one of these Dombrowski chaps yelled out a challenge, and these blokes must have had good loud voices, or the cavalrymen had good ears, because they answered the challenge and they went through. There were two horsemen who were obviously carrying dispatches, and so we went back to sleep then. And the following morning now, we were told to make our way over the Ebro, up on the hills, and to go along to Mora del Ebro, where we would reassemble. And I was very amused when I was explaining what had happened to the number 3 gun, to Bill Alexander, and he asked me one of the most ridiculous questions I've ever been asked. Did you get a piece of paper with a signature on it? And I looked at him in amazement. I thought, well, where the hell were you to think that people would be handing out receipts and so on in a desperate situation like that? And I said, of course not. I said, these men had no time for such frippery as that. What they wanted was to get the gun and get it through to the central front. And I said, now you know what happened to number 3 gun. Because they'd never been able to work out, because I was the only survivor. No, there were two survivors. There was another chap, a Scotsman, and his recollections are very hazy. But then, of course, we had to get across the Ebro, which, being summer, was at a very low ebb. We managed that, and when we got over the other side, the machine gun opened up on us. So we realised that the enemy was very close, and we marched along then, overnight, kept our direction, and we ran into, there was another cavalryman, and we were standing around near this farmhouse, and I put my hand up to stop this chap now to ask him a question, but he didn't know in the half light whether I was friend or foe. And out comes his bloody cutlass. And I never sidestepped so fast in my life. He's coming right at me, and I got out of the way. And obviously those chaps really had to be alert, because they'd get it travelling as they were at high speed on horseback. And so then we got to the reorganisation point at Mora.
Is that M-O-R-A?
M-O-R-A, Mora del Ebro. And we were there for a few days when I was on sentry duty with orders now to let no one go towards this bridge from the Republican side, because the engineers were placing charges to blow it up. And a car drove up. And for some reason, we had all acquired a hatred of Sefton Delmer, who had reported in the press that we had been wiped out and caused a hell of a lot of anguish. So I played possum and I said, well, where are you going? They said, well, we're looking, coming up to see what the battle is like, and we're going forward. And I thought, now, if one of you is Sefton Delmer, I don't give a damn. The whole lot of you can go and get killed. And if I had, it would have been a great disservice to the Republican cause. Because now the chap who was speaking to me, I sort of woke up to the fact that he had an American accent. And I said, excuse me, would you mind telling me your name? And it was that great correspondent of the New York Herald Tribune, I think. Was his name Matthews? But he had been a staunch reporter in support of the government. And I said, would one of your companions be a man called Sefton Delmer? No, he said. Oh, well, I said, I was just about to make a terrible mistake. I was going to go and let you go forward. If he was there, I wouldn't mind him getting bumped off. And he laughed. And he said, oh, no, he said, we represent the American press. And there was somebody from one of the French newspapers. So I said, that bridge is about to be blown. And I said, the enemy are very close there, so you'll have to go back. I'm to stop anyone going forward. And they turned back. So I could have been, been responsible for the death of some very good men.
I think there's an incident at Mora that you'd like to describe.
Yes, well, there were just a considerable body of troops, a number of officers trying to make order out of the chaos, and we got a meal, and then a fairly large number of lorries came along, and